This hour's top stories. UN experts say Guantanamo prisoners have suffered years of unending torture, calling on the new U.S. administration to close the notorious jail. Former U.S. Capitol security officials blame intelligence failures for the January attack on Congress, saying extremist groups came to Washington ready for war. Also ahead, authorities in Ecuador say nearly 70 inmates have been killed in prison riots in the Latin American country. Welcome to the World News. UN experts urged the new U.S. administration to address violations committed against the remaining inmates in the notorious Guantanamo prison. The experts pointed out that many of the prisoners are now old and vulnerable after what they called years of unending torture and deprivation of freedom. They demanded a transparent review of the operations in the offshore facility. The experts added that practices in the Guantanamo Bay jail were in breach of international law. They described the situation faced by the prisoners as, quote, Kafkaesque, stressing that they should receive adequate compensation. The White House had earlier said President Joe Biden would seek to close the center during his tenure. The infamous prison was opened under former President George W. Bush in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Political commentator Tony Gosling says the U.S. has created several offshore prisons in order to bypass human rights laws.
Guantanamo Bay, which of course many people forget, is actually part of Cuba. It was a naval base which the Cuban Revolution never managed to take over. And so it's doubly disgusting the Americans have not got the guts to do it on their own soil, under their own laws. And it's clearly an attempt to do this outside the law. You know, we're talking about a rather amazing technique here now, used in order to, and it's not, of course, just this prison, which is outside American law. So this is one of the tactics as part of the so-called war of terror, is for the United States to have lots of these prison facilities in places where the Americans' laws even do not apply. In fact, basically the only law applies in there is the law of the jungle. Tony Blair, of course, was involved in the process to kick all of this off in Iraq, the illegal war, but mainly in Afghanistan. The Afghan campaign is one of the reasons why, which filled most of the inmates in Guantanamo Bay. We had in Britain here a terrific SAS soldier blew the whistle many years ago about what was going on. They were being given bounties for collecting people that might potentially be suspects. They hadn't committed any crime, but they might be stragglers in a village that they'd been overrunning. And they would then simply put these on the extraordinary rendition flights, well, arrest them at gunpoint, put them on a rendition flight and send them to Guantanamo or one of these other special jails. Well, it then turned out that most of these people had committed no crimes whatsoever, apart from that they were Muslim.
Former U.S. Capitol security officials blame intelligence failures for the January attack on Congress, saying they did not expect that as such big riots.
As recent as Tuesday, January 5th, during a meeting I hosted with my executive team, the Capitol Police Board, and a dozen of the top law enforcement and military officials from D.C., no entity, including the FBI, provided any new intelligence regarding January 6th. It should be also noted that the Secretary of Homeland Security did not issue an elevated or imminent alert in reference to the events at the United States Capitol on January 6th. We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building.
Sun confirmed that the FBI had indeed sent a report to Congress security officials on the eve of the incident, which said extremists were coming to Washington ready for war. Speaking to two Senate panels opening a probe into security failures before and during the riot, a former House Sergeant at Arms also denied knowing about the scale of the security threat.
Based on the intelligence, we all believed that the plan met the threat and that we were prepared. We now know that we had the wrong plan. We did discuss whether the intelligence warranted having troops at the Capitol. That was the issue, and the collective judgment at that time was no. The intelligence did not warrant that.
Irving also denied claims that authorities had rejected calling up National Guard force ahead of the January siege of the capital, out of worry that such a move could look bad. On January the 6th, a group of supporters of former President Donald Trump raided the Congress. That came as senators convened to certify the results of the November presidential election, which Trump lost. He had, for weeks, claimed voter fraud was the reason he lost the race, leading to the breach of the Capitol. Five people, including a police officer, were killed in the violence. Colin Campbell says the protest at the U.S. Capitol was not taken seriously because of the people who were involved and responsible for quelling such a demonstration.
White supremacy is still the law of the land, although not a constitutional law, right? And the reason why I say this is because they had warnings before this riot, this invasion was going to happen. In fact, it was spoken about on social media too. But why was it that Capitol Hill police and National Guard and all of the people, law enforcement officers who could have protected the Capitol, were relaxed in the way that they approached these potential invaders? And it's an effort that is collaborated, right? It's not just the Capitol Hill Police, it's not just the National Guard, but also the Trump administration at that time was not giving the cues to their intelligence to say, listen, we may need to increase security on Capitol Hill. They thought that this would be something like an enlarged pep rally, so to speak, and they did not really take it seriously because of the people who were involved. Now, of course, some may say that this is a rush to judgment, but if past is prologue, look at the way that the Trump administration handled other protests that were not in support of him, right? Black Lives Matter, you had other protests that were going on. These protests were heavily surveilled. They had a lot of police. Some of these protesters were tear gassed. How could that be all but absent at the Capitol? That the administration and those who followed the administration took this crowd very lightly, despite the intelligence coming out the days before.
President of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has accused the U.S. and its allies of deepening the economic crisis in the South American country by imposing illegal sanctions. Legal experts say such sanctions amount to crimes against innocent people. From Caracas, here's Jesus Silva.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argued that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
At least 67 inmates have died and several others injured in riots that broke out in Ecuadorian prisons. Authorities have described the unrest as a concerted action by criminal organizations to generate violence in the country's jails. Violent acts among inmates were recorded in prisons located in three provinces. The government has, however, said one of the riots has now been controlled and that security forces are taking steps to regain control of the other two. Mexico and Argentina urged the UN and the world's richest countries to provide the poorer ones with better access to COVID-19 vaccines. In a joint press conference, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said the UN's scheme to ensure the poorest could get vaccines is not working. He said, "It's totally unfair that 80% of vaccine supplies are concentrated in 10 countries." His visiting counterpart, Alberto Fernandez, noted that he and his French counterpart are pressing the G20 to declare vaccines global goods. Inequality in vaccine rollouts have sparked criticism, with the World Health Organization accusing wealthy countries of hoarding vaccine supplies. Officials in Europe have called for a ban on public gatherings and partial weekend lockdowns as a number of countries' COVID-19 intensive care patients rose to a 12-week high of over 3,400. Regional authorities called for the restrictions as Paris continues to resist a new national lockdown to control more contagious variants of the coronavirus. The country has recorded over 20,000 new infections and 431 deaths. The figures raise the total cases to more than 3.6 million and the death toll to over 85,000. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said her country is now in a third wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Merkel also noted that the slow vaccination rollout and the risk of major outbreaks of fast-spreading variants have made any easing of restrictions introduced late last year more difficult. Algerian police have clashed with demonstrators demanding an overhaul of the country's political establishment. Violence broke out when student protesters defied police to demonstrate in the capital, Algiers. Reports indicated at least 18 people were arrested. This came one day after major demonstrations were held on the second anniversary of the anti-government protest movement that ousted longtime ruler Abdelaziz Bouteflika. The 2019 protest campaign was triggered by Bouteflika's bid to run for president for a fifth term. Rallies continued with demonstrators demanding sweeping changes in the ruling system that is in place since the country's independence from France in the 1960s. Now, the three European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have called on Tehran to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In a joint statement, foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany expressed regret about Iran's decision to suspend the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty. In the meantime, the U.S. State Department spokesman called on Iran to work with the U.N. nuclear body. The comments come despite a deal reached between Tehran and the IAEA, which temporarily extends inspections of Iran's nuclear sites for 3 months. Iran's parliament passed a law last December which required the government to take further steps to scale back Iran's commitments under the JCPOA, including halting the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. The parliament's decision was in response to the remaining signatories' failure to keep their end of the bargain. There seems to be no end in sight to the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. That comes as tension between the new U.S. administration and the Taliban have thrown doubt on a deal between the militants and former President Donald Trump. But behind the scenes, there are indications that the powerful U.S. military contractors may be pushing to extend the Afghan war.
The planned U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan hangs in the balance as reports show Washington plans to possibly extend its presence in the war-torn country. Afghanistan's neighbor Pakistan has now joined the fray with the Pakistani ambassador to Washington, saying the U.S. should consult the Taliban on any extension of a May 1st deadline for a full troop pullout under the Trump-era deal. Asad Majid Khan warned the U.S. against any unilateral decision. Khan noted, "The Biden administration's decision to extend military presence in Afghanistan will tarnish the cold credibility of the United States."
It is heartening to know that even high levels of the Pakistani government are speaking truth. That is a truthful statement. It is only going to sully the name and the nation of America, my birth nation, all the more that we are continuously sending American sons and daughters off to wars that have no purpose, no reason. And I agree with the Pakistani government official. I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Pakistan is widely seen as a major player in Afghanistan that wields significant influence over the Taliban. More than a year after Trump's administration signed a deal with the Taliban, U.S. and European officials say the militants have failed to abide by their commitments. They say conditions are not conducive to advancing the peace process amid the surge in violence, which they blame on the Taliban. The militants deny this and warn they will resume attacks on U.S.-led foreign forces unless the May deadline is respected.
But the Taliban are a useful tool where, at the high ranks, they're basically doing their whatever their marching orders are. And the United States has proven time and time again, if there is no reason to have a war, we'll make one up. We just continuously create some sort of scenario. What realistic threat does Afghanistan and the Taliban pose to the greatest military in the history of the world? None. Zero. They pose no threat to us at all.
Well, the total military expenditure in Afghanistan is reported to be around $800 billion from 2001 until September of 2019. Yet a study has revealed that that is a gross underestimate. It says the figure could actually be as high as $2 trillion. The same study says the coastal wars waged after the 9/11 attacks have reached almost $6 trillion. The human coastal war in Afghanistan needs to be mentioned as well. One study puts the death toll at $225,000, while other reports put that number at 1 million. This is while U.S. officials have constantly said they were making progress. The officials have been blamed for hiding unmistakable evidence that the war had become unwinnable. Check this out.
The new U.S. administration is rolling back Trump's policy, the withdrawal deal with the Taliban included. On the surface, the U.S. has steadily insisted it does not want Afghanistan to turn into what it calls a launching pad for new acts of terror like the 9/11 attacks of 2011. Some say with Biden at the White House, the United States is using Taliban attacks as a pretext to extend their presence in Afghanistan.
The intention is to keep American troops, Marines like me, keep them in Afghanistan to help continue running the heroin and ultimately do all sorts of nefarious, horrible things and killing war crimes and crimes against humanity, killing ungodly amounts of innocent people in Afghanistan under the pretext that we're fighting some war against a nation which poses no threat, and extend military might in line with the global spectrum dominance agenda.
Another theory maintains the Biden administration is under pressure from arms manufacturers to extend its stay in Afghanistan. Earlier this month, a congressional group recommended that President Biden extend the May 1st deadline for withdrawing troops. Word is, two of the group's three co-chairs and nine of its 12 plenary members have had financial ties to major defense contractors. The arms industry soaks up more than half of the $740 billion defense budget and will gain the protracted U.S. military involvement overseas. American author James Michener predicted during a visit to Afghanistan in 1955 that Russia and the United States would invade Afghanistan and both would come to regret it. That prediction came true. The Soviets invaded and were forced to leave Afghanistan in disgrace in the 1980s. Now, impartial military experts in the U.S. and its Western allies say the invasion of Afghanistan was a waste of blood and treasure from the very beginning and that this is an unwinnable war. They also advise the U.S. and other occupiers to seek a face-saving retreat from Afghanistan that has come to be known as a graveyard of empires.
Diverse range of programs. Youth. spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to the United Nations Global Survey on Digital and Sustainable Trade Facilitation, the Islamic Republic of Iran is above average regionally with a nearly 70% overall trade facilitation implementation rate. However, Iran could still increase its efficiency, especially for cross-border paperless trade measures. We have prepared for you an article written by Armida Salsia Alice Jahbana, Undersecretary General of the United Nations and Executive Secretary of the UN Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, or ESCAP. The piece is titled Accelerating Trade Digitalization in Times of the Pandemic. The article has been taken from the United Nations Information Center in Tehran. Saturday, 20th of February, marked the entry into force of a new international agreement promoting paperless trade, a timely reminder of how the COVID-19 pandemic has brought digital solutions to regional development challenges into the limelight. Paperless trade across borders has proven an effective way to mitigate trade disruptions since the onset of the crisis, enabling commerce to continue whilst limiting physical contact. Yet according to the United Nations Global Survey on Digital and Sustainable Trade Facilitation for Asia and the Pacific, despite the increasing acceptance of electronic documents across borders, implementation of cross-border paperless trade remains low. Across Asia and the Pacific, governments must move from time-consuming paper-based processes to electronic and traceable trade procedures that can significantly enhance competitiveness and address new challenges associated with e-commerce and the digital economy. In doing so, our region can also recover some of the $200 billion in illicit financial flows that sharply reduce the capacity of governments to put in place supporting measures for vulnerable groups. At the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, or ESCAP, in 2016, member states adopted the Framework Agreement on Facilitation of Cross-Border Paperless Trade in Asia and the Pacific to accelerate trade digitalization, the electronic exchange of trade-related data across borders, whilst leaving no one behind. More than 25 countries worked together to develop the treaty, which is now open for accession to all 53 members of ESCAP. The five countries that have ratified or acceded to the treaty, the Republic of Azerbaijan, Bangladesh, China, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the Philippines, represent a diverse group of countries spanning the wider Asia-Pacific region. But all are committed to regional cooperation in this critical area. Armenia and Cambodia signed the treaty in 2017, while several other ESCAP member states are in the process of completing their accession this year, before implementation of the agreement starts in earnest in 2022. But we must do more to realize the transformative potential of trade digitalization. Firstly, we need to fully use the framework agreement to provide a region-wide multilateral intergovernmental platform, A dedicated space for developing and testing legal and technical cross-border paperless trade solutions that build on national, bilateral, and sub-regional initiatives. This treaty marks the beginning of a new journey, one focused on turning cross-border paperless trade into reality through cooperation, testing, innovation, and implementation. Secondly, we have to ensure that the framework agreement is catalyst for those countries that become a party to it to implement key measures featured in the Trade Facilitation Agreement, or TFA, of the World Trade Organization, WTO, including single windows and other actions requiring the use of information and communication technologies. Thirdly, we recognize that the framework agreement is an inclusive and highly flexible cooperation and capacity-building opportunities that countries can participate in regardless of their level of development and digitalization. The estimates presented in the most recent regional trade facilitation report by the Asian Development Bank, ADB, and ESCAP suggest that the framework agreement can help reduce trade costs by more than 20% in most of the region's developing countries. So this is particularly important now when many bilateral or regional deals exclude some of the least developed countries. According to the United Nations Global Survey on Digital and Sustainable Trade Facilitation, the Islamic Republic of Iran is above average regionally, with a nearly 70% overall trade facilitation implementation rate. However, Iran could still increase its efficiency, especially for cross-border paperless trade measures. Joining the framework agreement sends a clear signal of the leadership's commitment and vision on trade digitalization, supporting the development of the country's digital services capabilities, and enabling Iran to shape the priorities and implementation of paperless trade in Asia and the Pacific region. I encourage all ESCAP member states to join the treaty as soon as possible and demonstrate their political will. There is no deadline for acceding to the treaty, but doing so early on will ensure a seat at the table when the parties formally discuss the implementation of priorities. The benefits of cross-border paperless trade multiply with a number of countries involved, so the more countries get on board, the larger the development gains for all. Under-Secretary General of the United Nations and Executive Secretary of the UN Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific Region, ESCAP concluded by saying, "It is time to accelerate the excellent bilateral and sub-regional paperless trade initiatives that have emerged across the Asia-Pacific region to build truly seamless and resilient supply chains as we recover better together in the post-COVID-19 era."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us start the day by pondering on an aphorism from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Incapacity is a catastrophe. Endurance is bravery. Abstinence is riches. Self-restraint is a shield against sin. And the best companion is submission to Allah's will.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our regular listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And I'd like to welcome my expert and guest, an academic, an Islamic scholar, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, and a good friend as well, who will give us insight on the subject of enemies. Who were the enemies of Imam Khomeini? May God bless his soul. And who were his friends? Because that's not something we've looked into while we've been doing this particular series of programs. And we're talking about the polarization of his character. What did he bring out in other people in terms of this relationship? That, you know, in terms of who were the people who were becoming his enemies, and who were the people that were his friends? So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I leave that entirely to you, because we're coming on the back of the fact that we were discussing about Imam Ali alayhi salam, and you know, Imam Ali is normally judged by his enemies because that's what we get from history. So, fire away, sir. Tell me what you think.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think it's clear for anyone who witnessed these things that exactly like Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was polarizing.
He was a polarizing character. Because we're talking about somebody who stands for principle.
Exactly. Mm. That just like his mullah, Ali, Imam Khomeini was a polarizing person.
He was.
And the point is that this is a good thing. This is the point.
Yes, yes.
When we say polarizing, immediately we have this negative
connotation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're not supposed to be polarizing.
Ah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to get along. We're supposed to get along with everyone all the time.
Yes.
Everything to everyone. Mm-hmm.
Right? And everything to no one.
Exactly. So, I would argue that polarizing is a positive trait.
I think so.
That we see in its greatest manifestation.
I think this is a fundamental characteristic of a mu'min, of a believer.
Of anybody who stands up for haq, for truth.
Truth.
Who stands up for justice.
Yes.
I'm talking about not, you know, occasionally, or when it serves him.
Right.
But as a matter of principle and as a matter of life, his own life.
Sure.
In the things that he does on a daily basis, in every situation, it will end up, you know, upsetting some people.
It will.
Especially people around him.
Exactly.
Who might be close to him.
Sure. I just wanted to raise a point that, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, Ruh Allah, spirit of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There is another spirit of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We call him Jesus, son of Mary.
Exactly.
And if I remember my Bible correctly, he had a lot of enemies.
Exactly.
He went to the temple in Jerusalem, and he hated the tax man, so do I. But at the end of the day, he had the priesthood, the rabbis, the scholars of his time, the doctors, they were called, the Pharisees. They opposed Jesus. They didn't like his message. They didn't like what he was doing. He didn't like the fact that he was performing miracles. But we're not talking about things on that level, but what we are saying is that seems to be part of the ethical makeup of what we're discussing here, that this is what happens when you have somebody who, as you quite rightly point out, sir, standing for truth, standing for what is right, standing for God, for principle.
Well, something's bound to precisely
and react to that.
Precisely. Mm. So we see that historically,
yeah,
the prophets, the imams, those who are our guides,
sure,
have been polarizing people.
People, yes.
And
for all sorts of reasons.
Right. Well, the main reason being is that they will not give in to battle. They will not give in to injustice. They will not give in to those,
thank you,
who might have power or who might
influence
who might be considered, yeah, the elites, mm-hmm, who might be considered those who are privileged.
Privileged, yes.
They will not give in to them,
no,
if it's a matter of truth and principle.
And justice.
And justice. And this creates enemies for them.
Yes.
Okay? Ibrahim, Musa.
Yes.
You know, all of them.
A whole long...
All of them.
All of them, yes.
And I would argue that maybe the greatest example of that is Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Of course. Without a doubt.
We even have this wonderful, small, short book written by Shahid Muttahari.
That's right, yes.
The polarization of
Imam Ali alayhi salam, yes. Great book.
Where, very briefly, he discusses this fact.
Yeah.
That it's not about, you know, being the most popular person all the time with everyone.
No, you're not. You can't be.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And so, my point of bringing this up, as you said, Eid al-Qadir.
Yes.
Which is the Eid in which, at the pond of Qadir, the Prophet, peace be upon him, in his final Hajj, declared that Ali is his successor.
Successor, yes.
And the Wali.
And the Wali. The Master.
Right. And everybody
swore allegiance. Who had allegiance with the Prophet had to swear allegiance with the Imam.
And they all did. And they all broke it.
Yes. And they all broke it. Yes, that's right.
Not all of them, but
yes,
the majority of them.
The majority of them did.
Right. Mostly. You had those who didn't.
Yeah.
Who are famous in Islamic history, yes, as the companions of Ali.
Ali, yes.
So, you know, this is the facts, yes, of the matter. And you see him from day one, whether it was within the Quraysh, whether it was among the tribes and among the enemies of the Prophet, from day one there are enemies of Imam Ali. And it is finally also his enemies that are the ones that, cause his shahada. And we see that in a very similar way, this reality exists for Imam Khomeini in his time.
Mm.
Because, you know, this is the beautiful thing about Imam, is that he didn't just sit in his study quarters, in his, you know, study room,
yes,
in Qom and just write the fatwas and not deal with unpleasant matters.
Sure.
His understanding of Islam, of a faqih, was not just simply somebody who theoretically, you know, talks about, as he says it, I'm saying this because this is his own words,
sure,
talks about bat urine, whether it's najis or pak,
sure,
you know, matters which are totally irrelevant to the lives of most Muslims.
Sure.
He actually saw himself, and this is the correct way of understanding Islam, as a person, both as a mu'min, but also as a faqih, and as somebody who is a scholar, who needs to implement Islam. It's not only about, you know, writing the fatwas theoretically or telling us what the ahkam are.
Sure.
It's about implementing them.
Mm.
Even in the Qayba, which is a big problem that we had with a lot of these so-called scholars, is because there was the Qayba, they figured, hey, whatever, you know, can't do much. Let's just stay home and be, as Imam Khomeini called them, pseudo-saints.
Exactly. Now, this is a very key word, isn't it,
okay,
in our discussion now, isn't it? Yes. The pseudo-saints, yes.
You know, there's no value. It's very egoistic, mm, to not look around,
mm,
in your life and look at the problems that the Muslims have, whether it's in your own city, whether it's in the Ummah.
Sure.
And not to do anything about it.
Exactly.
Or to try to do some small little charity action and think like, well, I've done my duty.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong. Some people don't have the capacity to do anything more. That's fine.
That's true.
We're not asking everybody to be, you know, like Imam.
No.
But I think most Muslims underestimate their own capacity and their own power and their ability to... And when I mean power, I don't mean power independent of Allah. I'm talking about this issue that we talked about before, which is the promise of Allah, which is that if you take a step, if you make effort, if you change your state, Allah will change your state.
Exactly.
If you change your own state, if you go on this path of helping Allah, Allah will help you.
Yes.
And they underestimate the power of this.
Yeah.
And yet, here's a man like Imam.
Who lived that.
Who lived that. And from day one, even before the activities were very political and overt, even before that, in the Hausa, you had people who didn't like him.
Exactly. Or disagreed with his...
Well, not only disagreed. I mean, disagreed is normal.
Normal, that's true.
It's a normal thing that happens among scholars.
Yeah, my disagreement was in much stronger terms.
Right.
They really didn't like the way he was thinking or what he was...
Well, they didn't like the fact that he was talking about implementing Islam.
Ah, thank you.
For them, they were in their safe little zone.
Zones, yes.
Let's just talk about it. Let's have our own little family situation where, you know...
With our tribe and village
or our own household.
Household, yes.
Right? You know, that within the walls, that's it.
Outside the walls,
I have nothing to do with it.
With it, yes.
Otherwise, I'll be thrown into jail, or otherwise they will, you know, come do something to my son. or my family.
Sure.
And yet Imam was not like that.
Yeah.
For him, it was about implementing Islam.
And he really implemented it.
It's about action. Mm. It's not about talking about it.
Sure.
Only. And unfortunately, what ended up happening is instead of those scholars understanding the breadth and the vastness of Islam, they reduced it to very personal ritualistic things.
Yes.
And said, we are implementing Islam.
Yes.
And putting aside all the social aspects of Islam, which, you know, as Imam says, you know, 90% of Islam is social. It's only 10% that relates to personal ritual things. But he talks about this in his book. He talks about that, you know, if you look at the sources, the ayat and the rabayat, he says it's 100 to 1 or you know, some vast ratio in favor of social matters as opposed to personal matters.
Exactly.
And yet we ended up in a situation where...
Where only personal matters are given the greater focus.
And those people were considered saints. And
yes.
They were really pseudo-saints because they were missing the main point.
Of course they were.
Again, we're not saying that people shouldn't do the personal thing. We're not saying people shouldn't
pray. No. But it has to be put in its correct context. It has to be in its correct perspective.
There's this famous there's a famous tape. Because, you know, before the revolution, he spoke, and this was called the revolution of the cassette. Right?
Yes.
And he would do the tapes. And he's speaking. And, you know, he was very authoritative.
He was already authoritative. Even though he was very mild in terms of his manner.
He didn't yell. He didn't... He was very soft-spoken, but he was very authoritative. And, you know, because he used to do akhlaq, ethics. He used to teach ethics. Tazkiyah nafs.
Yes.
You know, soul, self-purification.
Absolutely. He was renowned for
that. There's a famous tape where he's animated. You can tell he's upset. He's like, you know, my people are being killed, and they're telling me to give akhlaq dars. That is for self-purification. He goes, they're killing my... And he repeats it.
They're killing my people.
They're killing my people. And they're telling me I have to give... How can I give ethics class when my people are being killed?
Killed.
So this is the point.
Yes.
You can't give, you know, classes on ethics while your people are being killed.
Killed.
Do something about that, and then also give your ethics class.
Exactly. That's what needs to be dealt
right?
with first.
It's not
because
about
he's talking in the context, of course, when the Shah's repression was getting was reaching its heights in Iran in terms of curfews and, you know, the
execution, murders,
and
torture,
and the very same scholars being thrown off rooftops off the top of Fezia, for example. So I mean, come on. I mean, you're quite right, sir. Let's get this into perspective here.
Right. So, just like his mullah, who was loved and hated.
Loved and hated, absolutely.
Right? Hated by who? Hated by the enemies of God.
God.
Hated by the munafiqeen.
Yes.
By the hypocrites.
Yes.
Hated by those
pseudo-saints that were existing.
Hated by
at
those
that time.
Who want to maintain their privilege and, you know, live off Bayt al-Mal.
Yes.
Who want to, you know, take advantage of Islam and see what Islam can do for them as opposed to what they can do for Islam.
Exactly.
Hated by all those who, you know, grudgingly had to accept the Prophet, but in their hearts, never iman never entered their hearts.
No, faith never entered
right?
their hearts.
Who took advantage of the rahmah of the Prophet. And this is not a mistake of the Prophet. The Prophet is, you know,
he was
Rahmatullah.
Of course he was.
He's the manifestation of
he
divine
rahmah. Mercy of God or not.
There is no other thing that he should have done or can do but
except
to
show mercy.
The rahmah. Because that's his job in this world.
That was his job. Exactly. Thank you for putting
right?
it that
He's
way.
He's not
going to
suddenly be like, well, I know you're going to take advantage of me, so I'm not going to be...
No.
Just like Allah doesn't do that.
No, Allah doesn't do that.
We take advantage of his mercy...
All the time.
All the time.
Yes, I certainly do.
Right.
Yes.
We all do.
With me, it's a full-time job.
Right.
Yes.
And he doesn't...
No,
he doesn't stop being...
Merciful. I can't recall writing anything at the moment.
Right. We can't recall him not being merciful.
Not being merciful, exactly.
Right?
Thank you.
So... This is the Prophet who, you know, when the conquest of Mecca happened, was forgave the enemies.
Yes.
And they took advantage of it. Full advantage.
Full
of
advantage.
Okay, so these were the people that hated Imam Ali. Mm. In the same way, you have Imam Khomeini.
Mm. May God bless his soul.
Who, in a society which was very corrupt, which was based on fear, which was based on extreme class distinctions.
Yes.
Where you had, you know, super wealthy royalty
aristocrats.
And aristocratic level.
Elite, yeah.
And then you had a vast,
large peasant class.
And a small, you know, middle class, which basically was just trying to, you know, not get crushed.
Crushed, yes, basically.
You know, from
either side. Yeah, we end up being peasants again, yes.
This is a man who dared to stand up.
And challenge that.
And challenge all of it.
All of it.
You know, root from the root.
From
Not simply as a matter of just some tactical political matter.
No, no. From the root.
The whole legitimacy of this, you know, system that had been entrenched for maybe 1,000 years, where you really had this feudal society, this forced secularization and westernization from top in order to, you know, pursue America's interests and Britain's interests in the world and in the region for the, you know, 20th century, whether it was Britain first in the beginning of the 20th century, whether it was America in the second part of the 20th century, their whole secularization and top-down, you know, benevolent dictator approach that they had with the Pahlavi dynasty, and of course it wasn't benevolent, but this is the way they were justifying it. They were saying he's a dictator, but he's benevolent. He's trying to take his society, you know, towards civilization and towards westernization. So you have that. You have the whole feudal system.
Sure.
You have this illiteracy. You have this ignorance among the people,
sure.
which is vast. Mm. It's a mass ignorance. Mm. And here's a man who stands up to all this. So
Stronger.
Of course he's going to have enemies.
Of course he's going to have enemies.
He's going to have enemies within his own circles. He's going to have enemies within the scholars. Religious scholars. He's going to have enemies, of course, within the ruling elites.
Well, that's true. Because
he's going to have enemies, you know, in those countries that are supporting these ruling elites.
Sure. I mean, these are like, you know, for example...
He's going to have enemies among intellectuals and professors.
Absolutely.
And people who are so-called educated and so-called...
Pseudo-intellectuals, of course.
Right. Who think that by
who
becoming...
Who only want to get their own benefit out of the system.
Yeah, who are saying that, you know, we have to become Western in order to advance. And he's saying,
we have to
follow Islam to advance.
Of course, because he had an extraordinary insight into the message of Islam and from the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, was living them, and at the same time, as we've discussed in other programs as well, he's the living embodiment of Islam. I mean, he understands it on a level that, you know, even today, you know, we don't have that, you know, in a sense.
Right. And so, we see... that just, you know, as the example of his mullah, you have polarization. Polarization is not a bad thing.
No, it's not.
Having enemies gives you value.
It does.
This is one of the ways you can tell the character of a person. In fact, we have the Supreme Leader talking about this in terms of nations, about how nations, you know, who don't have enemies don't really have value.
No, they don't.
How is it possible that you would, you know, not have any enemies? We're not talking about small nations which need to just, you know, we're talking about nations who are, you know, have their own history, their own culture, who are, you know, pillars of human civilization,
sure.
who are not, you know, countries that are on the periphery,
sure.
I'm not talking about geographically on the periphery. I'm talking about civilizationally.
Sure.
Well, of course you're going to have differences. If you're going to stand up for haq, if you're going to stand up for justice.
Yeah.
Imam Ali, there's the famous story where, you know, he's the Khalifa and his relative, his cousin.
That's right. Yes. Very nice story.
You're
That's
Mr.
Right.
Hadith. So yes, please go ahead if you want to tell us.
No, I mean, I'll leave that entirely to yourself.
Well, basically, just to give you the gist of it, you know, he has his cousin who he likes and who likes him. And there's, you know, there's good relations in terms of friendship, friendly relations. Who wants money from
the Bayt al-Mal.
From Bayt al-Mal, from the treasury.
Yes.
And he takes...
He was asking for that extra money, and the Imam refused. He said, no, you can't have that.
And then he took a piece of burning...
burning stone.
Burning
because
coal.
And I think, if I remember correctly, he was blind, I believe. He was. And he gave that in his hand. And, you know, I'll let you carry
Well, basically, he said, why'd you do this? My hand is... He said, this is just so you that feel the fire.
Fire of hell, exactly.
When you do these things.
When you ask for these things.
When you ask for this, this is the result of it.
Mm.
Okay? So even with his closest relatives, he maintained justice.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, you know...
In other words, he was saying to him that you're getting your due share from Bayt al-Mal. You don't need anything extra.
Right. And not only that but this is what justice is.
This is what justice is.
It's not about me being your cousin and your relative.
Exactly. Because this was the whole intention of his asking, because he was trying to use that relationship to get something more out of it. And this was exactly the problem that Kufa was facing, because there was so much nepotism, so much of this favoritism that money was being expropriated. Going to the wrong people. There was a poor class in Kufa, for which Mawla, as we all have read and know from our childhood stories, that he was carrying flour and food to the doors of those people because of this corruption that had set into Kufa. And the Imam wanted to redress that, rebalance that. But unfortunately, we know about the battles and so on and so forth.
Basically, you see, and even more intense, the whole thing with Talha and Zubayr.
Exactly.
You know,
the companions who were
very close companions. You know, these were people who were there when Hazrat Fatima salamun alayha was being buried. Which is very rare distinction in human
and
history.
How that turned.
So we're not talking about, you know, low level people. We're talking about heavy guys.
Heavy duty stuff.
And yet he's even standing in front of them and saying, look, we can't, you know, why are you doing this? Mm. Why are you ruining everything for yourself? Okay? Mm. Now, let me just add this here. Mm. Exactly like Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Khomeini, his enemies acknowledged him as being somebody that is just.
Just.
And somebody who is, you know, capable and stands up for truth.
Mm.
So this is another thing that distinguishes somebody who is polarizing.
That's right, because when the enemy itself acknowledges the fact that you are right, correct on the principled stand that
you are
what you say you are.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So this is the point. You know, we have this unfortunate disease amongst us ourselves. I'm including myself as the number one
absolutely.
Person with this problem.
Sure.
Is
and
that
the one
we
that
think
you're talking to as well, discussing this. Yes, absolutely.
That we think that somehow, if we stand up for Islam, this is not going to be to our benefit. That somehow we should just, you know, tone it down a little. You know, don't... And when I mean tone it down, I'm not talking about, you know, in terms of expression. I'm talking about principle.
Principle, yes.
You know, well, we see that Imam Ali does the exact opposite.
He does the exact
We see that Imam Khomeini does exactly the opposite.
Sure. And this is why we unfortunately read in history the loneliness of Imam Ali.
Exactly.
And that is very, very difficult to express, because I can't help being emotional as soon as I say those
words. Of course.
Because this is the price you pay for,
of course,
trying to for doing the right thing.
Right. Now, Imam Ali in its greatest degree, but if you look at Imam Khomeini as well, you know,
it was very lonely.
Can you imagine
at the top?
You're 80 years old?
Yes.
And you are responsible for an entire nation, which is going through the deepest social revolution it's gone through in 1,000 years.
Years, absolutely.
You're fighting a war with the whole
world against you.
okay,
and with sanctions
and everything that goes with it. You're dealing with munafiq. You're dealing with munafiq who are who have pulled the sword. You're dealing with people within your own group who are actually agents of the enemies, and yet you handle it. And of course, this has to do with relying on God, and believing in truth, and standing up for truth. This is the greatest power anyone can have. The way you want power, I'm telling you this.
Yes.
You want power?
Sure.
Stand up for truth. Exactly. Allah will give you the power.
Allah will give you the power.
The minute you don't stand up for truth, Allah will be like, hey, you want me to give you power for not standing up for truth? And you know what? This is something we experience in our own lives. Just think about the situations in your own life.
Sure.
Those of us who've had a little bit more time to sin in this world.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yes, true.
Those times when you didn't stand up for haq, Allah gave you the answer.
He did.
He answered you in a way and you realized, oh my God,
I shouldn't have done that.
This is where I went wrong.
This is where I went.
And those times when you stand up for truth, where you stood up for truth,
yes,
and you fought it, and you handled it, and you had the sabr, and you had the patience, and you had the steadfastness, Allah rewarded you immediately.
Immediately. That's true.
Okay?
True.
So, we see that, you have Imam Ali alayhi salam, who, as Shahid Mutari says, is
sure,
this figure who is this person, is this being who is polarizing, pulls in the good, right, repels the bad,
the evil, the bad,
and those who are enemies of truth and of God.
Sure.
And exactly the same way, you know, whatever, 1,400 years later,
sure,
you have a person like Imam Khomeini who comes at a time in world history, at a time in Iranian history, at a time in Islamic history, at a time in global history,
sure,
and completely changes the equation.
And I tell you one thing though, this attraction, this polarization you talk about and repulsion is very true of Imam Khomeini, because we who were living outside Iran had nothing to do with what was happening here in the Islamic Republic, were simply found this attraction due to the basis of his righteousness, due to this principled righteous stand that Imam Khomeini was the living embodiment of, was immediately attracted those people who also want to join in that
good.
And the repulsion, yes, that was for those who basically are on the path of unbelief. So let them go their own way.
Exactly. So, and I think the one lesson we can learn from Imam Ali and from Imam Khomeini,
sure,
and Imam Ali as the main figure in this, and Imam Khomeini as that thing that we saw in our own lives, not just something that we read about.
No. I mean, this is
experience. Whenever you stand up for truth, whenever you stand up for Islam, whenever you stand up for God, even though it's hard in the beginning, Allah will reward you.
Exactly.
And whenever, and exactly the opposite happens. So don't think this is just one part of the equation. The other part of the equation is also true, which is that when you don't stand up for truth, when you compromise unnecessarily on certain matters, of principle, when you think that you are doing, you know, something with the enemies of truth because it will somehow, you know, help you personally, or it will somehow, you know, allow you to move on, then Allah punishes you in ways that you couldn't even have imagined.
Sure.
So let's not make that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And let's look at the example that we had with Imam in our lives and use that as the example in our daily lives.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, thank you very much for that insight, and I'm sure we're going to have much more deeper discussions exactly about this polarization in later sessions. But thank you very much indeed for your contribution today, and I hope the listeners have benefited from the program. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening today.